Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The big debate after the deadliest shooting in U.S. history isn't about gun rights. It's about whether to have a debate at all so soon after the event. Here's White House spokesperson Sarah Sanders at a press briefing on Monday.
There's a time and place for a political debate, but now is the time to unite as a country. There's currently an open and ongoing law enforcement investigation. A motive is yet to be determined, and it would be premature for us to discuss policy when we don't fully know all the facts or what took place last night.
Meanwhile, back at the ranch in the Ohio State House, six bills that would expand gun rights are pending. Lawmakers are talking about them. Coming up, we'll hear from both gun rights and gun control advocates. Joining us now from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, Andy Chow. Welcome back, Andy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Are there any gun control bills pending in the Ohio General Assembly? We know about expanding gun rights, those six bills, but are there any to restrict gun control?
Yeah, there's definitely bills that would regulate guns in Ohio that I guess you could say are pending. They're not going anywhere, but they have been introduced, mostly, of course, from Democrats, but mostly from House Democrats. And I think because of the past and because of the political landscape of the state house, they know that they're not going to get big chunks of restrictions in. So I think they try to do smaller things. So one proposal out there right now is to try to take guns away from people who are charged with domestic violence. And so they call it the cooling off bill, where if somebody is charged with domestic violence, then while the court case goes on with that case, that person's guns are taken away. So it's just kind of these smaller measures to try to restrict access to guns when this person has shown or has been accused of showing violent behavior.
And the likelihood of that getting through?
I believe it has had – I don't think it's even had a committee hearing at this point.
It's not the first time it's been introduced either, right?
Right. These types of things, trying to limit guns from people who have been charged with something, especially when it comes to domestic violence, they've been around for the past couple of sessions now, so past 6-7 years. And hasn't got anywhere so far. There's another bill from House Democrat Bill Patman. It has gotten one hearing, and it hasn't moved on from there. And this is the big one. This is the one that would close the so-called gun show loophole, where right now you can buy a gun at a gun show or from a private sale or online, and you can avoid having a background check. Mm-hmm. And that's called the loophole, the background check loophole. And there's a bill in the House right now. It has had one hearing that would require getting a background check. Hasn't gotten anywhere after that one hearing.
What are the objections to that?
I think that part of it might be of course, just the overall fundamental issue is that Republicans do not like putting restrictions on gun ownership or access to guns. And I think that's just one of the fundamental issue there. I think the other issue might be that it might kind of mix with federal laws. So if Ohio has one set of laws and then the feds have another law when it comes to background checks, that might be something that's tough, especially when it comes to online sales. So maybe somebody is living in a state where they are not required to have a background check to sell their gun online, but yet somebody from Ohio is buying a gun. So I think crossing state lines might be an issue there, too.
In general, how do you describe the trajectory of the politics of gun control issues in the Ohio General Assembly? I mean, is it more restrictive than ever? Is it more open than ever? I mean, is there a trend line we can look at and describe?
I would say that definitely when it comes to gun issues in the state house, it's definitely trending more towards more access to guns, and not really access to a higher volume of guns, but more where you can take guns. So at this point, there's no likelihood of tougher restrictions on guns coming out of the Ohio State House. But Ohio Republicans, who have the majority, have been working on several issues when it comes to expanding concealed carry. So mm-hmm. Where can you carry a concealed weapon? Being able to carry a concealed weapon without needing to get a permit, without completing a training course. That's called the Permitless Carry Bill. And then cutting into gun-free zone laws. So there are places that can put up a gun-free zone sign saying, I'm a school, I'm a private property, I don't want guns here. Yet there are pieces of legislation working in the State House right now to sort of cut into those gun-free zones.
One would make an exception for elected officials like state lawmakers who are making the laws.
Right. So there is a bill out there right now. It has not received a hearing. It's from the House. And it would allow anybody who is a state elected official or a local elected official in Ohio to be able to carry a gun into a government building.
What is the logic behind that? What are the arguments for it?
The sponsor says that the sponsor is a Republican state representative, and he says that he's had heated exchanges with constituents and with people on other issues where he's had somebody come into his office and he has felt, I think he stopped short of saying that he's felt threatened, but he's had heated exchanges. People have followed him from his office to the parking garage in the State House where he felt uncomfortable. And he's saying in that moment from when he leaves his gun in the car of the State House garage to when he goes to his office, he feels unprotected. And so he says that elected officials can be vulnerable in that way.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the gun control issues that are being debated at the State House these days. Maybe not in committee hearings, because some law bills can't even get a committee hearing. Others are being talked about, whether you like it or not. Regardless of the timing, after the most deadly shooting in modern U.S. history, they are talking about it. The question is, the debate seems to be more about whether we should talk about it publicly. And I think I've answered the question of where I stand on that debate. My guest is Andy Chow from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. And coming up, we're going to hear from proponents and opponents of gun rights in the state of Ohio. So if you have a question or comment, want to weigh in on this issue, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Are there go-to people for gun rights bills at the State House? So you mentioned the lawmaker that wants to make an exception for elected public officials. Is he a go-to guy for the gun rights lobby? Are there a couple handful of people that carry most of these bills?
Well, I would say there's go-to legislators when it comes to certain issues. So Representative Hood comes to mind. He has been the go-to person when it comes to the so-called permitless carry bill, where you would be able to carry a concealed weapon without a license. And he's introduced that at the past couple of sessions. Nina Vitale, the representative who wants to allow elected officials to carry concealed in government buildings, this is newer for him. I mean, he's always been supportive of gun bills, but I don't remember him being a lead sponsor, so this is kind of a newer thing for him. I think of Wes Rutherford has been pretty vocal on pro gun rights in the past. He has been a little less so recently because he fell into some controversy. He was found in a McDonald's parking lot drunk with a gun in his handrest.
Right.
So he was somebody who led a lot of bills on this issue and now has been quieter about it since.
What's happened since then to him, by the way?
Well, he has been not acquitted, but he pled no contest, and so now he's still legislating in the State House, and he's still appearing in committees and sessions and still sponsoring bills, just not as vocal as he used to.
Has he been sentenced?
Mm-mm. I don't believe he's going to be sentenced. I believe he is carrying out some community service.
Let's talk about what the most likely is to pass, even in this session.
Yeah, I definitely would say that the one bill that it was getting the most momentum so far, and again, I think it is relevant to talk about this because this is a bill that had a pretty big momentum, but might not go anywhere anytime soon because of current events.
Okay.
So it's a House bill that would allow somebody to carry a concealed weapon into a gun-free zone as long, and they won't face any charges as long as they are asked to leave and then they leave. So basically, let's say I'm carrying a concealed weapon. I walk into a gun-free zone. Maybe I didn't mean to. Maybe I didn't realize it was a gun-free zone. Right now, if it were just an accident, if somebody caught me, I would face charges. whether it was a mistake on my part or not. So what this bill would do, it would say, hey, it would make the property owner or somebody of that property to go up and say, please leave my premises. But the problem with that, the people who oppose this bill say that puts the onus on other people to confront somebody
who has
with
a gun.
Yeah. It makes them have to ask somebody with a gun to leave. And if that person is there for not great reasons, that can escalate a situation.
What does it mean to conceal carry? I mean, if you can't see it, then how is somebody supposed to know you have it?
I think that's a good point. You could maybe conceal carry and do it in a way where nobody even knows that you have a gun in the first place. But there are times where, I mean, I've been in places where somebody might have a jacket over their gun,
right,
and they reach into their pocket and then you see it. So there are times where it can be revealed. Sometimes it might be bulging out of the side of a jacket or something.
But
so
is there a legal definition for that?
It has to be covered. Just has to be covered by some type of clothing.
Okay.
So.
So that was the most likely to pass.
It was the most likely to pass. It passed out of the House and it received a hearing in the Senate. So, you know, when you pass out of one chamber and then you start getting committee hearings in another chamber,
deal.
That's a pretty big deal. So it seemed like, and there have been several gun bills that have been introduced, and this is the one that I believe has gotten the furthest. So that seemed to be the one with the most momentum at this point.
There's another bill. It was the seventh introduced this year, according to the Columbus Dispatch. It was rolled out on Tuesday in the Ohio General Assembly, and it would allow off-duty law enforcement officers to carry guns into stores and hotels, blah, blah, all kinds of public-type buildings that now—
Into gun-free zones, yeah.
Into gun-free zones. Mm-hmm. And that's one of those exceptions that there were—
Yeah, kind of that trend of chipping away at gun-free zone rights. So the issue with this bill is people say, well, a trained peace officer while on duty can carry a weapon anywhere. That's part of their job. So why take that right away once they're off duty? That's what the supporters say. Now, people against that say, well, these are locations where maybe private property owners have made the decision that they do not want guns on their grounds. They do not want people to carry concealed on their grounds. So they have likely made that decision thinking about, do I want an officer, even an off-duty officer, coming onto my premises? And so passing this bill, opponents say, would chip away at that right.
What's the support for that?
There seems to be a little bit of support. It's definitely a newer bill, introduced just last month. So I don't know where it's going to go. It got a couple of hearings already. It seemed like when it comes to this issue, when it comes to weighing the rights of private property owners who want to declare their property as gun-free and then weighing the rights of gun owners, this seems to be one of those times where Republicans kind of take pause and say, should we trounce on the rights of private property owners?
Because that's another touchy issue.
It's a big issue with Republicans and conservatives. And like chambers of commerce have come out and say, hey, this takes away the rights of our business owners who say that they don't want guns.
Anything else that we haven't talked about that is going to percolate, you think?
Yeah, I think the Stand Your Ground bill is going to be another bill. This would mean that you know, if you feel like you're in a position where you're threatened, and if you use a gun out of self-defense, then if you were to go to court in the past or currently, if you were to go to court, then your defense attorney has to prove that you are using self-defense. If this bill were to pass, it would put the onus on the prosecutor to prove that you didn't need self-defense. So it kind of flips the whole self-defense thing. It's the Stand Your Ground law. Another big issue with the Stand Your Ground law is right now you have to show that you tried to retreat from a situation before using the use of deadly force.
Like I tried to shut the front door.
Right. I tried some other method before having to fire my weapon. If this bill were to pass, it would take that away.
And what's the significance of that?
It's just one of those things. It's an issue that has been in conservative circles for a while now. People who feel like they want a gun, they own a gun, they have this gun to protect themselves. Why should it be on them to have to use another method first? Why should it be on them to retreat first? before using this gun that they have bought to protect themselves.
Andy Chow, thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
It's Andy Chow, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. We will continue our conversation. If you have a question or comment coming up, we're going to have proponents and opponents of gun rights laws in the state of Ohio. We'd love to hear from you if you have a question or a comment. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The big debate after the most deadly mass shooting in modern U.S. history is not about gun rights, but about whether to debate gun rights. Listeners, gun rights legislation is being discussed every day in one fashion or another at the Ohio State House. Six bills that would expand gun rights are pending on the dockets of the Ohio General Assembly right now. Joining us for the balance of the hour are two advocates. One's for gun control, the other one for gun rights. Jack DeRora practices law in Columbus. He serves on the advisory council for the Ohio Coalition for Common Sense. That's a group that advocates for safe gun policy. Welcome to the show, Jack DeRora.
And it's nice to be here. Thank you so much. And let me clarify one point. I like to use the phrase gun policy or gun safety because gun control is anathema. And perhaps it should be for gun owners. So we're not really trying to control guns. We're trying to promote better policy.
Okay. Dean Reek is executive director of the Buckeye Firearms Association, a group that advocates for expanding gun rights. He joins us by phone. Welcome, Dean Reek.
Good morning, Ann. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. We're going to be hearing from callers, you know, throughout the hour, I hope. 614-292-8513. I wanted to get to something that popped up in this particular case, and we've heard a little bit about this in the past, but the Associated Press and others have reported that the shooter, Stephen Paddock, had two bump stock devices that could be used to retrofit firearms to make them fully automatic weapons. Dean, is this legal in Ohio?
Yeah, and actually the latest report that I heard was that there may have been as many as 10 or 12 of those devices.
Exactly.
The bump stock is legal depending on how they're designed. Generally, a manufacturer will apply to the BATFE, what most people just call the ATF. They'll apply and get a letter of approval. And so generally, if you see these in a store, a retail store, or online, they are legal. However, they're not really something that most people consider a serious device. I believe this may be the first incident of this type where they've actually been used. Most gun owners consider them little more than a toy. It's something that you use for recreation, you know, on a shooting range. They're not particularly practical because they're not accurate. But it is unusual to see this in an actual incident. I don't recall seeing them used before. But again, the legality is about how exactly they're designed.
Why are they necessary? I mean, I get what you're saying. Most people don't consider it a serious device. They're not very accurate. Why have them? I mean, why have them legal? Why would anyone want them?
It's just for recreation. Most people, and I don't think they're even all that popular.
Recreational, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of people, and I've been to a lot of ranges, and I recall maybe once seeing somebody use them. Again, they're not, you know, from what I've seen, they're not particularly popular. It's just a way to you know, have fun at the shooting range. And so I've not seen them used in this kind of incident, mm-hmm. and I don't know that that there would be any reason for, you know, a lot of concern about this. But you know, the facts are still coming out on this case. We don't even know for sure whether the guns that these were installed on
were actually used.
Right.
But whether all of them that were found were installed on the guns, what you have to understand is what this device actually does is mimic something that can happen even when you're just holding a gun. There is a way to hold a gun loosely, and what happens is the gun moves back and forth as it's firing, and it brings your finger into contact.
Just kind of like a drum, like when you're on a snare drum. Yeah, that's what I kind of...
Back and forth. And it's hard to comment on it because I don't know exactly what this guy did or whether they were used or how he used them.
Right. But we know there were several there. And it does explain to a certain extent, if they were used, it would explain the length of time that the shots were being fired and the repetition that sounded, at least in the air. Jack DeRora, is this... Dean Reek says it's really not something that's that popular. It's not something that's used that often. We really haven't heard about it in one of these kind of mass shootings before. I have heard of it, though, before. Is it an issue when it comes to gun safety?
I think it is, because while Dean has characterized this as something used by gun enthusiasts at target ranges and therefore doesn't have much impact on the rest of society, I think every time we come up with some invention that increases the lethality of a semi-automatic weapon, we give way to more acts of mass violence, as we saw. So in my view, it should be an issue.
I'm going to turn to Hannah right now. She's making a point from Columbus. Hi, Hannah. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I just had a quick question. I'm not sure if anyone can answer it, but a couple minutes ago, there was a bill brought up that would eliminate the need to get a permit for concealed carry weapons. And I'm just curious as to what, like, the purpose of that bill is, why it came up. Because to me, it seems like it's just skipping a kind of important step, and I could be wrong because I'm not very educated, but I was wondering if any of you could speak to that and just give me some info about it.
Dean Reek, can you talk about that? That's a bill that would just—it's not necessarily likely to pass in Ohio, but it has been introduced here. Why eliminate the concealed carry permit altogether? What are the arguments for and against that?
Well, I'm assuming that she's talking about HB 201, which is generally referred to as constitutional carry, where you don't have to apply for a license; you just carry if you choose to. And there are actually, I know that in Ohio, you know, we know our laws here, but there are actually 12 or 13 other states that have constitutional carry, states like Alaska or Arizona. Probably the most famous is Vermont, where they have no licensing system whatsoever. And if you choose to carry, you carry, and you just obey all the other laws. And none of these states seem to have any problems with this. You know, it's all about the person. If you're the kind of person who's going to carry responsibly, you're going to do that regardless of the licensing system. And if you're going to carry irresponsibly, you're going to do that too. There tends to be a persistence of behavior. So the reason that this is being pushed in Ohio is that it just removes the burden for people who would want to carry a firearm for self-defense. I don't know how much you know about the process for getting a license, but it can be fairly burdensome for the average person. There's a lot of red tape, and there's a long process that you have to go through.
Jack DeRora, what about this? I mean, what is the value of a concealed carry permit if you're going to do something nefarious anyways? Does it matter?
I think it does. First of all, I'm not sure that the concealed carry training regulation is all that burdensome. It's about a 12-hour class. I think we have to take a step back and think about what we're doing. The gun enthusiasts would say that the Second Amendment covers everything that has to do with firearms. And there's really a difference between what the Second Amendment provides and what gun enthusiasts want. And the Second Amendment is not clear on its face. It's the subject of tremendous litigation. We're trying to figure out what those 20 words or so mean, because they're certainly not clear. So here's the way I look at it. And this is kind of a long answer, so forgive me and indulge me, please. But we seem to forget that guns are, and here's quite the understatement, instruments of death. Now, in the hands of the right people, that danger is manageable. I would imagine the dean does everything appropriately, handles his firearm safely. But the more we can ensure that people handle those firearms safely and use them responsibly, I'm all for it. So I don't see the value in minimizing the training and allowing people to carry without a permit. Now we're taking steps backwards with instruments that are very hazardous and hazardous for the people around them, and we're disregarding all the collateral issues that come with more guns.
Dean Reek, you said, you know, as far as what the red tape is, you said it can be onerous. Jack DeRoyer referred to the 12-hour class. I remember I had to take a lot of classes to get my first driver's license, right? I haven't had to do it since then, but at the outset I did. What's the difference in your mind, Dean Reek?
Well, I would point out again that constitutional carry is legal. Depending on how you count the states, there's one state that's a little debatable on whether it's actually constitutional carry, but there's at least a dozen states where you have this kind of carry, and they don't seem to be having any problems with it. So my question would be, what is it that's so different about Ohio residents that would make them more dangerous than the people in New Hampshire or West Virginia or Wyoming, Kansas, Maine, Mississippi, all of these places you can carry under what is called constitutional carry? You just choose to carry and you obey all the other laws, like don't go out and shoot a bunch of people. So the extra burden really doesn't change the person. And because of real-world examples from these other states, we're seeing that it doesn't cause a problem, that the training really doesn't change the person. Now, I'm all for training. Mm-hmm. In fact, we promote training. I've gone through significantly more training than the average person, but that's always a good thing. But we always have to remember that we are talking about rights here. You mentioned driving a car,
mm-hmm.
and you know I went through that training when I was very young, and I got my license, mm-hmm. and so on. And it's good to have that training, and it's good to have extra experience. But driving is a privilege; it's not a right. Firearms are a right, and we can debate about exactly what those rights are, but that's what makes it extremely different, and we never want to lose sight of that. So Buckeye Firearms Association is always out there protecting gun owner rights, because organizations like the ACLU, for example, will protect every other right you have,
mm-hmm.
but they just don't like the Second Amendment. For whatever reason. So it makes an organization like ours necessary, and we need to push back against those who would infringe upon those rights in order to attempt to gain more safety. Again, we always look to the real world. We can argue the theory, but if I'm going to look at these 12 or 13 other states, I know that they're not having any problems whatsoever.
Okay.
With this, and so why wouldn't we have it here?
Jack DeRoyer?
I'd like to address two points. First of all, I think Dean speaks to what I call the false narrative. He talks about certain groups not liking the Second Amendment.
Like the ACLU.
Right. I don't think it's a matter of people not liking the Second Amendment. And certainly that's the battle cry from the gun lobby. We have to protect ourselves from those people who want to take away the Second Amendment. I don't think that's on anybody's agenda. It's certainly not on mine. The issue is, how broad is that Second Amendment right? Now, Dean likes to pose it in terms of the difference between a right and a privilege. And he's right about that. Mm-hmm. There is a difference.
That's a real thing.
But every right is limited. Let's look at the Constitution. We have the Fourth Amendment. There is a right to be free from unreasonable searches. But courts are fighting that issue every day. Forgive me for using the word fight. Litigating.
Mm-hmm.
How free are you from unreasonable searches? In certain circumstances, police can enter your house without a warrant. They can probably search your car without a warrant in certain situations. So there are exceptions. We have a right to trial by jury. But if you don't follow the procedures of a court, you can waive that right. We have a right to be free from cruel and unusual punishment. What does that mean? That's the subject of litigation. So it's not just that this Second Amendment is a wholesale grant of unlimited gun rights. It has limits. The problem is those limits have not all been defined.
Mm-hmm. Dean Reek, what about that? I mean, good point. I mean, nothing's wholesale. Freedom of speech, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater, right? There's exceptions.
Well, I mean, guns are very heavily regulated. There is this narrative that you know, guns are not regulated very heavily. In fact, that they are. They're regulated at the manufacturer level. They're regulated at the retail level. They're regulated at the individual owner level. So when we're looking at this, you know, we try to look at what is the point of each of these laws. After an incident like what happened in Las Vegas, you know, within 5 minutes, people are coming out and say, let's pass this law or that law. And often those laws have absolutely nothing to do with the incident itself. And because we've been involved in this in quite some time, we know the long game of those involved. Now, you know, I can't speak to what Jack's personal beliefs are. We don't know each other personally, but we know the major players in the gun control movement. They've been around for a long time, and this tends to be a very top-down sort of movement, funded from the top down. And we've seen in the past, you know, they used to be a lot more honest about it. You would have groups called Handgun Control Incorporated, and they found that, you know, through focus groups and so on, that kind of honest message with what they wanted to do really wasn't working. So they started a more incremental approach and trying to soften the language. And I know that it's difficult for the ordinary person to see that, but when you've been watching this for so many decades, mm-hmm. you can see what the game really is. And, you know, when we're called paranoid, when we talk about firearms, we're worried about firearms being taken away. But that really is the goal. The goal is to severely limit access and to try to mimic, you know, what other countries have done. Hillary Clinton was even talking about this during the campaign, about Australia.
Yeah, well, Dean Reek, though, you know, when I was talking to Andy Chow at the outset of the program, though, I said, what's the trajectory been in recent years? And, of course, I've been following it, but I'm not a State House reporter anymore. I'm not as close to it as I once used to be. But the trajectory from where I sit and the way Andy Chow described it has been purely on the side of gun rights in the last 30 years.
I agree with that. And the reason that that's happening is that you have somewhere around half of the adult population in the country who have firearms.
Right.
I would love to take a lot of credit for that. I'm sure the NRA would like to take a lot of credit for that. But the fact is that the legislative victories that we have and the cultural changes that we've seen really have to do with the number of people who believe in gun rights and who own guns. But that doesn't mean that a threat isn't there. You know, it wasn't that long ago that we had an assault weapon ban in Columbus, Ohio.
Right. So Jack DeRora, I mean, is Ohio Coalition for Common Sense, it's a group that advocates for safe gun policies, safe policies, but is it duplicitous to have a, why not just say, anti-gun rights?
Oh, that's not our mission. And in fact, the head of our organization, Mark Kelly, former astronaut, husband to Gabby Giffords. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many firearms he owns, but it's a number. He's a gun enthusiast. So when I hear Dean talk about this underlying secretive mission of taking away guns, I have to ask, where do you get that idea? Because I've never seen it in print. I'm not advocating it. My group isn't advocating it. I've never seen it written down, and I've never heard it in just common talk. So I don't know where that comes from. So the focus is on public safety, not taking away guns. Let's change the conversation just a little, if I could. 30,000 people die a year in the nation from gun homicide, gun suicide. 30,000 people. Now let's look at that as if it were an aviation problem. Let's say we have 200 passengers per airplane in an airliner. 30,000 people dying a year from airline crashes. That would be 150 airline crashes a year. If we had that problem, we would be taking serious action to cure it. But for some reason, with gun violence, we wring our hands and we say there's nothing we can do. So it's more than just gun rights. It's a public hazard. It's a public safety issue. And we cloak, we cover our eyes and say we can't do anything about it because of the Second Amendment. And I think that's just plain wrong.
We are going to continue our conversation. You just heard from Jack DeRora. He's a lawyer in Columbus and serves on the advisory council for the Ohio Coalition for Common Sense. That's a group that advocates for safe gun policy. And also, Dean Reek is executive director of the Buckeye Firearms Association. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The big debate after the most deadly mass shooting in modern U.S. history is not about gun rights per se, but about whether to debate gun rights. Listeners, gun rights legislation is being discussed every day in one fashion or another at the Ohio State House and in Congress. Six bills that would expand gun rights are pending on the dockets of the Ohio General Assembly right now. So joining us for the balance of the hour are two advocates, one for gun control and the other for safe gun policy. Jack DeRora practices law in Columbus. He serves on the Advisory Council for the Ohio Coalition for Common Sense. That's a group that advocates for safe gun policy. And also Dean Reek, he's with us by phone. He's executive director of the Buckeye Firearms Association. And that's a group that advocates for expanding gun rights. And he joins us by phone. And thanks again to both of you for joining us today. One of the issues that has endured for many years now is the so-called gun show loophole. If you're 18 years old in most states and aren't otherwise barred from gun ownership, you can legally purchase a firearm from a gun show or from a seller on the internet, not have to go through all that, the red tape that you mentioned earlier on, Dean Reek. The loophole, to any kind of loophole, there's always people who say, well, why is there a loophole? Why should there be a loophole? If it's, and I know you've already said that you think all the red tape is onerous and unnecessary anyway, but why the loophole for private dealers and gun show sellers?
Well, there's a big misperception about that. We hear people talking about how this huge number of guns are sold without going through a background check at gun shows. And that's just not true.
How many are there?
Very few. If you look at the statistics from the FBI, they've done studies on this, on how many crime guns actually come from gun shows, and it's a negligible amount. I've seen figures as low as 1% or even lower. What people are really talking about when they're talking about the gun show loophole, that's a marketing term for this idea. They're talking about private transfers. Mm-hmm. So if you were my neighbor living next door and you know, you own guns and there's a particular firearm that you didn't want anymore, didn't use anymore, and I say, hey, you know, I'll take that off your hands. It's a private piece of property. You can sell it to me. And we don't go through a background check. That's how the majority of those happen. It's not at gun shows. It's just private property transfer. You mentioned the internet. Mm-hmm. Again, there's this myth that people go on the internet and you buy guns without going through a background check. That is not true, unless you're dealing, you know, with an out-and-out criminal, or, you know, with what they call the dark web. If you go to a website, and a lot of gun dealers around Ohio have websites, and they'll have mm-hmm. firearms. You go and you select one. That's just another way of selecting it. You're still going to go through the background check.
Well, what about Craigslist type of things, though?
Well, you're talking about private transfer.
Right.
Again, let's say that instead of living next door, you live in Dayton, and you have a firearm, and you want to get rid of it. And so, okay, I'll come up to Dayton, and I'll meet you. and, you know, we'll have a private property transfer. That is perfectly legal. You know, that is not going to be where crime guns are coming from. You know, the people who are doing the most violent crime out there tend to be, you have two people who are blatantly violating the law. You have someone who knows that they're selling illegally, somebody who knows that they're buying illegally, and they're not going through any of the normal means. So let's assume that we go ahead and pass a law that closes this so-called loophole.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if I'm not obeying the law anyway, I'm not going through background checks, and the guy I'm going to buy from, he's not doing background checks, that's going to have zero effect.
Mm.
So, you know, that's always the catch-22 of these things, is that if you're not willing to obey the law anyway, if you're already violating mm-hmm. the law, more law isn't going to make any difference.
So, Jack DeRora, what about that?
I don't know if Dean is right about the number of sales from gun shows being negligible. Perhaps he's right. I can't say with certainty that he is, but I'm a little doubtful. Regardless, it seems to me that if it was appropriate to have background checks for firearms when you buy them from, let's say, Dick's Sporting Goods, there's no reason not to have a background check for each and every sale. To not have consistency makes no sense. Second of all, I'm not sure if Dean is right, that all crime guns come through means other in situations where there's really some situation we can't preclude. I don't buy that. For whatever reason, we're not making a good enough effort to crack down on the source of those guns. It may be that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms is handicapped in how it traces guns that are used in crimes. There's literature out there to show that its tracking mechanism is outdated and it's not able to effectively trace where guns come from. So to say that, oh, it's going to happen anyway, well, that's the typical argument we always hear. Why do anything? Criminals aren't going to abide by it. We can't do anything about it. And you know what? This is the only aspect of society where we make that argument. If we're faced with any other problem in society, we say, how do we fix it, darn it? What are we going to do? But here we say, gee, nothing we can do about it.
I was just going to go to a call. Kirk in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Kirk.
Hi. I had a question for Dean.
Dean Reek? Okay.
Yeah. I just wanted to know his opinion on the there are a lot of countries, like outside of the U.S., with stricter gun laws, and they have a significantly lower amount of gun violence and mass shootings. I just want to know his opinion on the correlation between these two things.
Well, there are a lot of statistics on this, and what you tend to find is there is not a correlation. There are countries that have tons of firearms, and they have very low crime rates. There are some that have tons of firearms and very high crime rates.
Well, tell me a country that has tons of firearms and low crime and low crime rates, or low gun, not crime rates, but gun violence.
You have countries like Czechoslovakia, for example. They're big gun nuts over there. They love lots of firearms, and they tend not to have a big problem with them. John Lott has done statistical studies on this. I'm not an expert on all the statistics, but he's done correlations where he's looked at, you know, countries around the world, gun ownership rates versus crime. You know, what you really tend to find is that crime is a cultural issue. It's not a matter of the tools that are available. So, you know, in a country like Japan, for example, you tend to have very low crime,
mm-hmm.
just sort of across the board because of their culture. And you have other countries that are the opposite. So you don't really see a high correlation. And the other thing that I would point out is in the United States, we've seen the number of firearm sales, you know, skyrocketing in over the decades, and rates such as suicide rates or crime rates aren't going up. If they're correlated, you would seem that they would move in concert. In fact, the overall crime rate, when it comes to firearms, has been going down for the past 30 years or so. And so, you know, I don't see that correlation between guns and crime.
Jack DeRura.
Well, first of all, Dean refers to John Lott, an academic who makes a living by furthering the notion that more guns is a better idea. John Lott has been largely discredited by his peers. There are lots of academics out there who are concluding that more guns result in more deaths, and not more deaths of bad guys. John Donahue from Stanford, Mark Duggan, who I think is with the University of Chicago, David Hemingway from Harvard. I think the statistics are showing just what I've said. More guns result in more incidences of death. The other thing is, I'm struck by this notion of, well, other countries just have different cultural norms, so they can have lots of guns and less violence. I don't know if that's true or not, but that hardly is a basis for us to do nothing here. That's like saying, well, we're different. We're going to accept 30,000 deaths a year just because. I have a hard time being good with that notion.
Well, I would like to push back on that a little bit, because this notion that we don't want to do anything about it is false. It's just a matter of what is it that we're going to do, and is it going to be effective? You know, let's look at this 30,000 deaths figure, Jack, that you mentioned earlier. Two-thirds of that is suicides. So, you know, why aren't we talking about suicide prevention? One of the things that Buckeye Firearms Association has been involved with, for example, is we become part of a program led by the Ohio chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and it's called the Store It Safe campaign. And this involves accidents with very young children. So it deals with talking to parents at the pediatric level when there's a checkup for their very young child, say 5 or under. And so people who have very young children and firearms, a conversation can be had at that point, and then there are free gun safes available for those people. So that's one example of where we can look to promote safety. I just came back from Dallas over the weekend at the Gun Rights Policy Conference, and I had a very interesting conversation with a woman who is from Washington State and is involved in suicide prevention. And one of the interesting things they're doing is trying to find a way to reach out to the firearm community, because gun owners tend to be very suspicious of medical professionals. But in my conversation with her, I realized that maybe here in Ohio there is a way that we can do that to lower the suspicion and to allow gun owners to talk to other gun owners who are certified in suicide prevention and attack the problem that way. So I would rather go, you know, let's look at what the numbers really show us. Let's look at where deaths actually happen, and let's attack it directly. Let's not, you know, try to continue over and over again to legislate mechanical devices. That just picks us down a rabbit hole. We're never going to solve the problem that way.
Jack DeRura, we have about 1 minute left. You have the last word.
Dean, I think you're right. We have to look at gun violence in its different components. There's violence against kids, that is accidental shootings. There's domestic violence. There's gangland violence. There is suicide. Each one has to be handled individually. And by the way, Dean, we may have met because it was my Kiwanis Club that donated $10,000 to the American Academy of Pediatrics for those gun lock boxes.
Well, how about that? We have common.
Something in common. Jack DeRura, practicing lawyer in Columbus, serves on the Advisory Council for the Ohio Coalition for Common Sense. Thanks for joining us today.
Wonderful being here. Thank you.
And Dean Reek, Executive Director of the Buckeye Firearms Association, thanks to you as well. Always appreciate your time.
Thanks, Ann.
Thanks to everybody for your emails, for your calls. Thanks especially for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.